Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:35 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is July 9th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with a reasonably long-term chart of the VIX index, because there's a couple of things that tend to rhyme over the history of this index. So certainly there have been times when we get this historically low volatility, and certainly we can also think about back in 2017 that the number of times when the index traded below 10 exceeded all of the other occasions when it traded below the 10 level. So that was a period of time when the stock market just went up. 2017 was a remarkable year because it was the only year where we didn't have a reaction of more than 5% over the entire 12 months. And since then, generally when you get these very depressed periods of volatility, they're followed by periods of extreme volatility. We saw that heading up out of the low volatility period of 2005 and 6 into the high volatility period of 2007 and 8, and then the higher volatility period through the uncertainty of 2018, and the whole question about quantitative tightening and just what Jay Powell was going to do, and then heading into the pandemic as well. When we do get these extraordinary spikes, we can also remember the rule that spikes in volatility are much better indicators of lows than lows of volatility are of peaks. So certainly when you get these extraordinary moves in volatility, it's generally an indication that the low is pretty close to being put in, regardless of how scary the overall environment is. And it takes time for the volatility to come back down again. And certainly we can go back and think about what happened in 2010 or 2009 and 2010 and even into 2011. People were fearful. They thought that the trauma of the credit crisis was about to be revisited any day, that we were going to have another significant drawdown, that the other shoe was going to drop, that all the banks were going to go bust, and it never happened. But we had this lurching environment where people wished that they had sold at the top. So instead, they started to deploy the lessons that they had learned, which was to take a profit when you see it. So there was a lot of volatility in 2009 and 10 and 11. But it does take a while for that volatility to come back down. And that's what we've seen over the course of this year as well. So when we think about the consistency of the trend that's been evident since March of last year, every peak, with the exception of this one higher high in November of last year, has been a lower low, or excuse me, has been a lower high. And the period, the amount of time that the index can sustain a rally is getting shorter. So it has been as much as 3 or 4 days, and right now it's looking like not much more than 1 day, and even then it was only half a day, and the VIX came straight back down again in here today. So this is eerily similar to the kind of environment that we had in 2017, where the stock market didn't pull back by a large amount, and we haven't had reactions that are, at least certainly in 2021, the size of the reactions has been comparatively small. So if we just simply take the largest one and look at the size of that pullback, well, we're only in the region of about 5 to 6%. So we haven't gone a year without a reaction of more than 5%. It's not quite as good as it was in 2017, but it's not far off it either. And The question, of course, is, well, what's similar and what's different between now and then? And the big glaring similarity is the quantity of liquidity, because 2017 was the year after Trump administration came to power, initiated big tax cuts, particularly for corporations, and then also allowed corporations to repatriate profits from overseas with no penalty. So there was a massive flood of liquidity that surged into the market, and it was a perfect example of a pro-cyclical set of policies because the economy was already expanding at a healthy clip ahead of that, and then it got this additional boost, so that translated into higher prices overall. And now we're looking at the aftermath of the pandemic, and people are still worried about variants. But there are a couple of things that are, I think, worth reminding ourselves of. The first is that not everyone is susceptible to any kind of coronavirus. There are plenty of people who will go through a normal cold and flu season and not get it, get the cold or flu, regardless of how much they are exposed. So some people have natural immunity, and nobody has been talking about the rate of natural immunity for the coronavirus. So that's the first thing. The second is that there's been good research released that people who are or have historically been exposed to the common cold generally tend to have milder symptoms. So that's an additional factor that doesn't seem to get a lot of media coverage. What we are instead treated to is this constant barrage of dastardly and very worrying statistics about how much more contagious and difficult to treat the Delta virus is. But this is only applicable to the populations around the world who have not been exposed to common colds, have low natural immunity, and then also are older. So we certainly have higher numbers of cases appearing in the ASEAN region at present. And one of the reasons for that is because they're doing more testing. They weren't doing any testing last year, so it's very hard to find cases if you're not looking for them. And then we have the additional point that vaccines are available. Now, there is a raging argument about whether one should take a vaccine or not, but that is largely beside the point because what we have evidence of is that they are at least a solution to the rising number of difficult to treat cases. So there's news that the Pfizer vaccine, which has been the one most used in Israel, and Israel was the test case for a country with a reasonably small population that inoculated, but not too small, that inoculated the majority of the population, although there was the clear example that the Orthodox community were unwilling to take the vaccine, and so were a large proportion of the Arab community. So even in Israel, there was still a lot of hesitancy about taking vaccines. And even there, we still have good data that a large number of, or I guess there's a large percentage of infections don't progress to severe illness. So that's the primary rationale for everybody getting vaccinated. It's to take pressure off the healthcare system. Now, obviously, people have got these concerns about the long-term effects of vaccines. And there's legitimate questions because we don't know. We couldn't possibly know because these things are brand new, and we probably wouldn't know for at least the next 5 years until we have data that can really be depended on from long-form studies. So it makes perfect sense that people will just weigh the risks, and that's why there's this rollout of vaccines. But then, of course, there is the additional point that having engaged in lockdowns, then politicians weren't going to be able to unwind the lockdowns until they have something to point to and say, here's the reason why we're ending the lockdown. And that reason is vaccines. So they have always been saying that once vaccines were available, then lockdowns would end. And that is exactly what's happening. So we're going to have a global rollout of vaccinations, and people will be encouraged to take them. And it's likely that this is going to go on for a while. But the most important thing is we're unlikely to go back into the same kind of lockdown environment that we had to endure last year. So there is this very similar fear that we see in the market today that we had in 2009 and 2010. And even into 2012, when we had the sovereign wealth crisis in Europe and people were worried about another big default crisis, and it certainly ended up in a big transfer of responsibility from the private sector to the public sector, and then it resulted in failed fiscal austerity in the Eurozone, which gave rise to populism. But all of that, those might have been negative consequences, but it did not translate into negative consequences for the stock market. So there's certainly the potential that we're going to have flare-ups of viruses and various variants and alphabet soups of different names for variants over the next few years. But the most important point is that the ability of the virus to tamper with the outlook for stocks has decreased almost completely. And it would require significant new news or a brand new worry to really change the outlook. But that does not mean it's not going to continue to affect monetary policy and fiscal policy. So this is why stocks remain firm. And when we think about the outlook for stocks, again, it's quite similar to what we had in the early period after the credit crisis. This has been a liquidity-fueled rally for the last 13 years, and it remains a liquidity-fueled rally. So the European Union is now talking and acting out their intention to completely transition the economy to carbon neutral. So Stellantis in here this week said that they are going to spend upwards of $30 billion on a new suite of battery factories. And the share didn't prosper on that news, although it was a little steadier in here today. And overall, it's still in an uptrend. The reality is that companies are going to be encouraged to adopt battery technology, and there will be a greater proportion of renewable energy in the product mix. But Europe is going all out, and they are going to massively increase the number of charging stations. They're going to massively increase the number of hydrogen refueling stations. They're going to build the infrastructure to become carbon neutral. And in the process, they're going to try and gain the mantle of saving the world. But there are a lot of different reasons for why Europe in particular is attempting to, or is adopting this suite of strategies. So the first thing is that when your geopolitical competitors are all energy importers, then it's okay for you to be an energy importer as well, because it's not a point of competition. When the largest importer of energy in the world becomes one of the largest exporters, then it becomes a point of geopolitical competition. So Since the USA became energy independent, both Europe and China have become much more concentrated on becoming energy independent. So, without significant domestic sources of oil and gas, they are both going down the renewable energy path. And right now, China is a lot further along in achieving that goal than Europe is. So, Europe is going to have to spend a ton of money in order to achieve their goals. And we're talking in the region of trillions. So then when we start thinking about what that means, well, for Europe, they also need to try and come up with a rationale for how to unwind fiscal austerity. Fiscal austerity did not work. It only resulted in revolutionary movements springing up all over the Eurozone, and a great deal of disaffection with the EU overall. And then it probably was a contributing factor in the UK eventually deciding to leave. So all of that has contributed to a difficult environment for the most significant economy in Europe because they are being blamed. The creditors are being blamed by the debtors, and Germany, being the most powerful economy, the economy that has done best from the creation of the euro, and then subsequently did best as a result of fiscal austerity, has also now got negative yields. So the country can borrow and be paid to borrow money. How are they going to unwind the fiscal austerity and try and hold the whole economy together? And how are they going to avoid the very real threat of a debt deflation? Because the sheer quantity of debt that's outstanding in various parts of the European Union hasn't got a prayer of ever being paid back. And the only possible way that Europe is going to overcome these kinds of challenges is to coalesce around a unifying idea, something that can drag the various populations of the continent together behind a common cause. So, peace and prosperity was not enough because they didn't deliver enough of the prosperity part, and people become complacent about the peace that the European Union has successfully delivered. So now they're being sold this opportunity to become the leaders of the world in terms of climate and looking after the planet and becoming the guardians of the future. And this is all extremely ethical and being sold as a moral imperative, and there are going to be substantial spending plans as a result of that. It's going to be used as a rationale to abandon fiscal austerity. The ECB just this week have changed how they measure inflation, and that is probably even more important than the current plans to go off and spend a pile of money on the renewable energy sector. Because one thing that we know about central banks is that they not only control money supply, but they also control how inflation is measured. And measuring inflation is difficult. And they have had certainly a very long record of depressing how inflation is measured. And now they are much more concerned with increasing how inflation is measured. So, the number one thing that they did to ensure that inflationary pressures did not pop on the upside was to remove commodities and energy from the measure. Now the ECB is putting them back in. But they're putting them back in via the back door. So they now have a carbon credit market, and it is politically motivated in its nature. So they're not going to allow carbon prices to come down. They're going to ensure that they rise. So this is a clearly politically motivated uptrend. It's a perfect example of political arbitrage. And if carbon is included into the inflation measure by the ECB, well, then it's going to clearly influence the inflationary outcome. Because if they're not going to allow the price to decline and they're going to ensure it rises, well, then that's purely inflation. If they then expand the number of industries to whom carbon credits apply, then it becomes a greater inflationary pressure. Then, when they also include house prices rather than rents, then that includes an additional point towards inflation. So, central banks can change the narrative by changing how they measure inflation. That's what the ECB is beginning to do. They are going to ensure they meet their targets for inflation because they're literally changing how it's measured. Against that background, it is difficult to believe that German government bond yields are going to remain negative because they are going to go out and borrow a very large sum of money to achieve their climate goals, and then they are also stoking inflation. So that will help to moderate the responsibility of governments to their debt. Then the mutualization of the borrowing is also going to increase. So the ECB's buying of bonds is well in excess of $1 trillion now, their pandemic economic purchase program is up to 1.18 trillion, and that shows absolutely no signs of slowing down. So when we ask ourselves, well, what is the rationale and will there be a reflation trade? The thing that I've found quite interesting over the course of the last few months is how quickly sentiment is bobbing back and forth. And I think the best term for it is that it's flighty. People are not willing to commit, and they want to, and they're jumping in and out of they're jumping in and out of themes from practically one month to the next. So this is obviously indicative of a lot of nervousness in the markets. And also that we're in a period of time where there are a lot of uncertainties. But the uncertainties, I think, are probably not nearly as pressing as one might be willing to believe, because there is a lot of things we can be certain about. The first is that money supply has increased by about 10 trillion in the last year, or at least in 2020, and the trend continues higher. So this is telling us that central banks have increased liquidity by nearly 50% in the course of the last year alone, and they are not going to allow the global economy to fall back into a recession. They are certainly talking about tapering. So the Bank of Canada is already tapering. The Royal Bank of Australia is talking about tapering. Bank of England is talking about it. The ECB is talking about it, and so is the Federal Reserve. They're talking a good game, and investors even started to believe it. And but the bigger trend here is that the total assets of central banks is up to 31.5 trillion, and it's not falling. And there's no sign yet that it's about to fall. And if the ECB follows through with its big anti-carbon program, or the European Union, I should say, well, then that's going to require a lot more money printing. So we have the answer for where the liquidity is going to come from. China today cut their reserve requirements for banks. So that will put another 100-odd billion into the economy. It might be tempting to think that the Chinese economy is rolling over. I think it is probably much more accurate that what we are now seeing is that the massive outsized demand that for exports that occurred in 2020 is ebbing, and the Delta variant is rising in a number of emerging markets where there are fewer vaccinations, so it is going to become more of a challenge for those healthcare systems. Well, then that is a challenge for the Chinese economy, because with recoveries happening in Europe and in the USA and some of the supply chain issues starting to moderate, then that will reduce demand for emergency supplies from China. And at the same time, the sources of demand that held steady last year will start to moderate if the Delta variant continues to emerge and infect more people in the emerging markets. And that pretty much ensures that there isn't going to be an aggressive move to taper and raise rates. When we look at the bond market, then we're presented with this rather interesting scenario, because back in March, there was a clear consensus that, I think we can even go back even further than that, and go back to the period of March of last year, when there was a clear consensus that the USA was going to go for negative interest rates, and that we were going to see the US 10-year Treasury go negative, and that bond yields in North America were going to go the same way as bond yields in Europe. And that did not happen, and instead we had a pretty significant rally where the yield went from 50 basis points to about 1.75. And then in March of this year, there was this clear conclusion that inflation was inevitable, that we were going to have that the only way to invest was with cyclicals that could weather the inflationary storm, and that growth was done for, and that we were going to see yields climb up to 3% imminently. And over the course of the last 3 months, we've seen that the yield came the other way. So now we've definitely seen over the last 3 weeks this growing contempt for the cyclical trade, and the willingness to think that growth is the only way to go. And we've had really impressive breakouts from a significant number of the largest cap companies. And Amazon, in particular, has been up in a dynamic manner over the course of this week. So there is this conclusion now that bond yields can't possibly rally, and that we're going to see growth take off as a result. But bond yields have rallied, and the VIX index is starting to come back down. And we have to think about, well, why were bonds rallying in the first place? Well, one of the reasons why bond sold off in the first half of this year is because of the sheer quantity of issuance. And there's been a dearth of issuance recently. So that has contracted supply and allowed dip buyers to gain dominance. So yields started to come back down again. Then we have had the talk from the Federal Reserve that they're going to taper their purchases, and that is a response to a stronger economic environment, and that then investors have concluded that they don't need to have a safe haven, or quite as strong a safe haven. Then there's been demand for equities, but then we've had this contraction over the last while that maybe the in yields, because people were doubting that conclusion that maybe the recovery isn't going to be quite as strong as people have been anticipating, and economic surprises have been coming in negative. So if we look at the economic surprises for the US, they have been declining for most of this year and went negative this week. So everybody was overestimating economic results because of the strength of the rebound, and now they are starting to become more realistic, but they're going to have to start re-upping their estimates, because now they're downgrading their estimates. They'll probably overshoot on the downgrades, just like they have over every other single one of the cycles in the last 20 years. And it's quite likely that we're still going to have a clear economic revival. Now, there's this other additional argument about how people react to these kinds of stresses. Are we going to have the savings rate starting to come back down? And I think this is, I think, one of the big questions, because the savings rate has been higher now, around and well in excess of 10% for most of the last year. But it has narrowed significantly. And the big question is whether people are going to go out and spend, and what are they going to spend it on? The one thing I think is particularly important is this is not like other pandemics. And the big reason for that is that there's been this massive amount of money poured into consumers, and there has been huge efforts to try and cushion the impact on individuals. So the lesson that people have learned is that they will be bailed out. And if we get another crisis and the same round of efforts are made to cushion the impact to consumers, then they will have less need to hold on to precautionary savings. Because one of the reasons why savers in China, for example, hold on to so much in terms of precautionary savings is because they know that the government is not going to step in and support their income, and is not going to step in and supply with their medical needs, and isn't going to step in and cover their loans or have a moratorium on evictions. So when consumers understand that that will occur and that governments will step in, well, they don't have to save money. And in fact, they're better off not saving money. And this is exactly the lesson that the airline sector has learned, because airlines are a volatile business, and planes are expensive. And what the companies did was, when they were profitable, they gave it all back. They bought back their own shares, and the index went sideways from 2017 to 2019, despite the fact that they were buying back large numbers of shares and paying dividends. So when the crisis hit, they had no resources, and the stocks collapsed. The index went from 350 to 100 in the space of about 3 months, and they were bailed out in spades, because governments are not going to allow the airline sector to simply disappear. So the mismanagement of the companies translated into a surety that they would be bailed out, because they are economically essential. So they have absolutely no incentive to act in a proper manner or to withhold income in order to allow for future problems. But one sector that does, because it's much more global in nature. Because airlines might fly internationally, but they do tend to be national champions in nature. But when we look at the automotive sector, Volkswagen sells a lot of cars in the USA. Toyota sells a lot of cars in the USA. When we think about the European market, Japan sells a lot of cars in Europe, and South Korea sells lots of cars internationally. So they are now presented with an, a rather different environment. Toyota has come through the pandemic in rather good shape, and the share has broken out to new highs. And they were able to achieve that because, in the aftermath of the Fukushima earthquake, they started holding more inventory in a precautionary manner. And when we had the semiconductor shortage, and that is still going on, well, it ensured that they were in a stronger position than their competitors. So companies like Ford and GM have had to curtail their production. They've even been paying top dollar for second-hand cars so they could turn around and sell them as certified pre-owned. And they are paying people to delay taking possession of their cars. I've heard of people being offered $1,000 to delay taking taking delivery of large pickup trucks. So that suggests that they are in a at a competitive disadvantage. And what are they going to do in order to deal with that? Well, the chances are they're going to start holding more inventory. So that means that they will hold inventory of chips, and they'll start to hold inventory of other key commodities, because automotive companies are new entrants into the semiconductors sector. So they have to demonstrate to the semiconductor companies that they are reliable partners and that they will continue to buy. So it's understandable that now they'll also start to hold inventory. But then we also have to think about it the other way around, that historically the automotive sector has been the one of the primary buyers of steel. And now we're also starting to see that because they are moving increasingly towards the production of electric vehicles, and there's going to be a lot more demand for electric charging capacity. Well, then that's likely to create competition there as well. So we're in a secular bull market for copper, and copper prices continue to steady from the region of the trend mean. And we were due some consolidation around the region of the all-time peaks, and we're getting it. But this has been a 15-year range, and we're consolidating in the region of the upper side of it. So really, a sustained move below $4 would be required to even begin to question the potential for additional upside. We are in a clear supply and elasticity meets rising demand environment, because there are whole new sectors opening up for demand for copper, and there is a long lead time to opening new copper, world-class copper mines. And it's usually you'll tell you're at the end of the copper cycle when people start talking about the copper mountain in Congo, because there are plans to go off and develop that mountain every single time we have a bull market in copper. Of course, now we also have a bull market in cobalt, and they both come from the same country. So we can anticipate that there will be an infrastructure boom in Africa, because a lot of the resources that are going to be required to achieve the utopian dreams of politicians are going to come out of Africa. And we can also think then that there's going to be a whole range of different commodities will be required. So the last commodity bull market was about oil, and it increased the cost of production for just about everything. Well, this new bull market is really about carbon. And there is a bull market in the price of carbon, which is increasing the cost of production of everything. And the response to that is substitution. So we're seeing an accelerated path towards substitution, which is creating demand for copper and the other battery technologies. But it's a headwind for oil over the long term, but less so in the medium term. And certainly, oil prices remain steady. So we're still in an environment where it's liquidity fueled. And there are clear arguments for why this liquidity fueled environment will contribute to economic growth. And then the question is whether one would be better off investing in value or growth. Well, value is an odd way of thinking about it, because value would incorporate low priced items, but it would also incorporate cheap. And of course, cheap is something that can be viewed in terms of history, or it can be viewed in terms of the future. It's cheap relative to potential innovation and upside, or it's cheap relative to what it used to trade at. So oil prices are in this rather long range, and I still believe that it is very unlikely that we're going to see prices trade above $100 anytime soon. We're already starting to get political pushback, and the reality is that there is a lot of oil sitting out there, and that OPEC has a clear incentive to ensure that oil prices do not rise to a level which will contribute to economic contraction. So I think that we have got scope for some additional upside, but that this is not a secular bull market candidate. We can then think about the gold price. Well, there's going to be a lot of liquidity, and there is certainly an intention to try and erode the overall burden of debt through inflation. So gold has steadied over the course of the last 2 weeks, and it had a whopping downward dynamic about 4 weeks ago. So that certainly would have stunned investors, and certainly there's a bit of deer in the headlights action right now. However, if we continue to see money being printed and no real plan for how debts are going to be paid back, and we start to see the reality of universal basic income, which is looking, we had a trial run for it during the pandemic, and whenever the next crisis comes, it will be rolled out en masse. I think that that is quite clear. So it means that the purchasing power of fiat currencies is going to be under pressure. And there is the clear potential here that what we are seeing in gold is a higher reaction low. So upside follow-through next week would go a long way towards confirming that hypothesis. So we are at an extremely interesting period for gold, because supply is relatively limited and there is a clear demand story. Well, then of course, people will be also looking at things like Bitcoin. And Bitcoin prices were down rather heavily yesterday, and we're a bit steadier in here today. And the amplitude of the range has been narrowing. I remain very much of the view that regardless of when the promise of fintech, cryptocurrencies, blockchains is eventually delivered upon, that Bitcoin is unlikely to be the underlying asset, and it will be some form of additional alternative. I've been having conversations with crypto aficionados over the course of the last week, and the one thing that I cannot wrap my head around is why there has to be a value on a token. Now, I understand the rationale for why that is currently the case. It's viewed as an incentive to secure the network. But Facebook provides an incentive for its social network, and it creates something that people are addicted to, social media. And by people tapping and swiping constantly because they want to, then they can provide a service basically for free, and then they take the data and they can sell it and make money from it. Well, the whole purpose of cryptocurrencies is that they don't get the data and that you pay for the services. But people are not accustomed to that kind of business model. And I just don't see the groundswell of support for privacy initiatives. I really understand why people might want their privacy, and I certainly don't. I don't use social media myself, and I have absolutely no intention of starting either because I don't see the purpose of it, and I get my news and entertainment elsewhere. But I do understand that there are lots of other people out there who find it to be by far the most accessible. So when we think about what that means for cryptocurrencies, well, they may come up with an app, and somebody smarter than me will eventually figure out how to deploy these kinds of technologies in a manner that will capture the imagination of the global population. But we do not have that yet. And at present, these assets are a function of liquidity. So we can think about what was the transition that created this massive move from 4,000 to 65,000, and it was global liquidity. We had exactly the same thing happening in 2017. There was first the halving, which was a rationale, but it could not have happened. The big move in 2017 could not have happened without the liquidity to support it. So the most important point about markets is that capital is both global and mobile, and it flows to the most promising assets. So promising assets will sit there and do nothing until there is a flood of liquidity, and then the liquidity will flow to the thing that has the greatest potential to rise. So we've had the big bull market, and now the big question is, where's the next really big flow of free cash going to come from? Because infrastructure development, where money is printed and then deployed into infrastructure, then that's not quite the same thing as spraying money at consumers and buying back a whole load of bonds and flooding the financial system with additional liquidity. So those two types of money creation can create asset price inflation in non-real world assets. So that contributed to the surge in art prices, the surge in collectibles. There is currently a surge going on in the value of Pokemon cards. And those are the kinds of assets that do well in a broadly liquidity-rich environment. But in order for Bitcoin to regain its peak and achieve the goals that were set for it when it was trading at 60-something thousand and approach values in the hundreds of thousands and even up to a million, it's going to require a massive new splurge in money creation, which means that we would need a crisis larger than the pandemic. So the next halving is in 2024, and we can anticipate that prices should bottom ahead of that. But in order to achieve the same kind of increase, where prices would multiply significantly and go up in excess of 10 times, then we would need an additional source of liquidity to fuel that. So crypto went up by about $1 trillion in market cap in 2020, and global liquidity increased by about $10 trillion. So the rationale would be that crypto can attract about 10% of global liquidity, or new money being printed, to be more accurate. And until we get that massive push of new money, then the clear incentive to pour additional resources into crypto just will be lacking. And this is a new correction. It's only been going on for 3 months. And we've seen that Bitcoin is quite capable of being in corrective phases for substantially longer than 4 months. So I do think that gold has got better potential to outperform Bitcoin over the medium term. But thinking about gold, we should also pay attention to the Dow gold ratio, because we've had a meaningful move in the Dow, and it is now pushing new highs, and gold prices have been correcting for 9 months, or actually 10 months. So now the Dow gold ratio is back in the region of the peaks from back in March, and it has rebounded pretty significantly from the lows in March of last year. So it's back above the trend mean, and it's breaking the sequence of lower rally highs, and it's got a consolidation going on right now above the trend mean. So I think there is at least the potential logic here that we may be looking at a recovery in the Dow gold ratio, and that the Dow can advance and gold can also advance, although perhaps not at quite the same pace. And all of that is predicated on money and money printing. So this is an interesting environment. And then there's the potential that inflation is going to pick up. And the early portion of an inflationary cycle is beneficial to stocks, which is what we are starting to see now, that stocks have clearly broken on the upside. And with Europe about to embark upon a massive infrastructure build, then that is likely to be beneficial for European equities as well. The Japanese market also benefits in a global reflationary environment, and the performance of the TOPIX, where it's consolidating below that psychological 2000 level, is also indicative of just a pause within a broader recovery scenario. So we're definitely seeing that liquidity and the outlook for secular bull markets evolving right across the global equity space has certainly improved. And it's likely to be led higher by cyclicals and by the commodity sector overall. Growth is very dependent on interest rates. So interest rates are going to remain low for a while yet. But bond yields have the potential to start to price in future inflation. And that is likely to act as a headwind to companies that rely on access to liquidity to fund unprofitable operations. And there are plenty of those. And then there are going to be companies that have come through the pandemic in flying colors, or with flying colors, but then run into trouble reaching profitability in a more normalized environment. I believe that Zoom is one of those companies, and it's now testing its sequence of lower rally highs. So it will be interesting to see whether it can rally enough to push up and away from this range. And there are plenty of other companies like that. I think that at the home or the food delivery type of businesses are another example. They have been rushing to IPO. And then we also have the fact that the Vision Fund, where they released this presentation a few years ago, saying that they were, that SoftBank was building a company to last 1,000 years. And this, I think, was at the height of hubris. And what they are doing now is trying to exit as many of their positions as they can get away with. And they pulled a fast one in trying to get Didi listed in the USA. Well, what China is doing is closing off that loophole. And Didi's stock price was a little bit steadier in here today, but the mood has changed in China. And the kinds of companies that they were supporting when they wanted a domestic demand story, then they feel like they've achieved their domestic demand story, so they don't need them anymore. And instead, they are curtailing their power, and they've basically confiscated their data, where data has become commoditized and is now owned by the state. Instead, what China is doing is supporting the battery sector. So the CEO of Contemporary Amper X has now got a fortune greater than Jack Ma, and the share continues to march higher. So this is the power of a company that has got the full backing of the central government and a CEO who knows how to toe the party line. India is being held out as, or is at least hoped for, as being the counterbalance to China in the Asia-Pacific region. So it is going to get any kind of support it requires in order to beef up the economy. And certainly I've seen more products that we're fitting out a house right now, so I always look at where things are manufactured, and I've definitely seen more products being made in India. So there is certainly a manufacturing evolution going on in India, and the stock market tends to be volatile. So when it does pull back in a violent manner, it has been universally a buy, and there is no reason to believe that that will not remain the case. It is the buy and hold market for the very long term. But it is certainly being supported and will be used as potentially the front line against the global reaction to China's dominance. And that's an additional strut to Europe's pioneering efforts to become the saviors of the world. They're going to start taxing the imports from overseas based upon the quantity of carbon that was used to manufacture them. So that is not going to be greeted with enthusiasm by the emerging markets. Most of those places, they have been able to prosper through manufacturing because they are less lax in terms of environmental regulation. So Europe is now exporting its regulation through tariffs. That's clearly protectionist, but it's not being viewed as protectionist. And these are just parts of the geopolitical puzzle as they evolve. And there is a competition to get to be at the top dog. We're in a multipolar world, and these are just simple examples of how this story is evolving. But the way to feed that story is with liquidity, and we still have plenty of that around, which supports the bull market environment overall. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.